Even one so powerful could be outmaneuvered by lesser creatures if the time and the setting were right. And that was both the lesson and the task of the day. Finished with his prayers, Daryai called for Bedrain. The younger man was a skilled tactician and gatherer of information. He needed the direction of one schooled in strategy, but with that guidance he would be very useful indeed. It had been conclusively decided in an hour's conversation with his country's leading experts that the president could do absolutely nothing at all. The next move was simply to wait and watch and see. Any citizen could do it, but America's leading experts could wait and watch and see a little faster than anyone else, or so they told themselves. That would all be done for the president, of course, and so Ryan walked out of the Situation Room, up the steps, and outside to see wet, cold rain falling on the south lawn beyond the overhang of the walkway. The coming day promised to be blustery, with March arriving, typically like a lion, then to be replaced by a lamb. Or so the aphorism went. At the moment it just looked gloomy, however nurturing the rain might be to ground recovering from a cold, bitter winter. "This will finish off the last of the snow," Andrea Price said, surprising herself by speaking unbidden to her principal. Ryan turned and smiled. "You work harder than I do, Agent Price, and you're a..." "Girl?" she asked with a weary smile. "My chauvinism must be showing. I beg your pardon, ma'am. Sorry, I was just wishing for a cigarette. Quit years ago. Kathy bullied me into it." "More than once," Jack admitted with good humor. "It can be tough being married to a doctor." "It can be tough being married." Price was wedded to her job, with two failed relationships to prove it. Her problem, if one could call it that, was in possessing the same devotion to duty that only men were supposed to have. It was a simple enough fact, but one which first a lawyer and then an advertising executive had failed to grasp. "Why do we do it, Andrea?" Ryan asked. Special Agent Price didn't know either. The president necessarily was a father figure to her. He was the man supposed to have the answers. But after years on the detail, she knew better. Her father had always had such answers, or so it had seemed in her youth. Then she'd grown, finished her education, joined the service, worked her way rapidly up a steep and slippery ladder, and in the process lost her way in life somehow. Now she was at the pinnacle of her profession, alongside the nation's father, only to learn that life didn't allow people to know what they wanted and needed to know. Her job was hard enough. His was infinitely worse, and maybe it was better for the president to be something other than the decent and honorable gentleman John Patrick Ryan was. Maybe a son of a bitch could survive better here. "No answer?" Ryan smiled at the rain. "I think you're supposed to say that somebody has to do it. Jesus, I just tried to seduce 30 new senators." "You know that?" "Seduce," Jack repeated. "Like they were girls or something, and like I was that kind of guy. And I don't have a fucking clue." The voice stopped cold, and the head shook in surprise at what he'd said. "Sorry, excuse me." "That's okay, Mr. President. I've heard the word before, even from other presidents."
"Who do you talk to?" Jack asked.
"Once upon a time, I'd talk to my father, my priest, to James Greer when I worked for him, or Roger until a few weeks ago. Now they all ask me. You know, they told me at Quantico, at the basic officer school, that command could be lonely. Boy, they weren't kidding. They really weren't kidding." "You have one hell of a good wife, sir," Price pointed out, envying both of them for that. "There's always supposed to be somebody smarter than you, the person you go to when you're just not sure. Now they come to me. I'm not smart enough for that." Ryan paused, just then hearing what Price had told him.
"You're right, but she's busy enough, and I'm not supposed to burden her with my problems."
Price decided to laugh.
"You are a chauvinist, boss."
That snapped his head around.
"I beg your pardon, Miss Price," Ryan said in a voice that sounded cross, until a presidential laugh followed it. "Please don't tell the media I said that."
"Sir, I don't tell reporters where the bathroom is."
The president yawned.
"What's tomorrow look like?"
"Well, you're in the office all day. I imagine this Iraq business will wreck your morning. I'll be out early, back in the afternoon. I'm going to do a walk-around tomorrow to check security arrangements for all the kids. We have a meeting to see if there's a way to get Surgeon to work and back without the helicopter."
"That is funny, isn't it?" Ryan observed.
"A FLOTUS with a real job is something the system never really allowed for."
"Real job, hell. She makes more money than I do, as for 10 years, except for when I was back in the market. The papers haven't picked up on that either. She's a great doc."
His words were meandering, Price saw. He was too tired to think straight. Well, that happened to presidents, too, which was why she was around.
"Her patients love her. That's what Roy says.
Anyway, I'm going to look over arrangements for all your children.
Routine, sir. I'm responsible for all of the arrangements for your family. Agent Raymond will stand post with you for most of the day. We're moving him up.
He's coming along very nicely," Special Agent Price reported.
"The one who got the fire coat to disguise me back on the first night?" Jack asked.
"You knew?"
Price asked in return.
The president turned to enter the White House proper. The grin was one of exhaustion, but for all that, the blue eyes twinkled at his principal agent.
"I'm not that dumb, Andrea."
No, she decided. It wasn't better to have a son of a bitch as POTUS.
Chapter 21. Relationships. Patrick O'Day was a widower whose life had changed in a particularly cruel and abrupt way after a late-life marriage. His wife, Deborah, had been a fellow agent in the laboratory division, an expert on forensic investigation, which had occasioned a great deal of travel out of headquarters, until one afternoon, flying into Colorado Springs, her aircraft had crashed into the ground for reasons still undetermined. It had been her first field assignment after maternity leave, and she'd left behind a daughter, Megan, aged 14 weeks. Megan was 2 and a half now, and Inspector O'Day was still wrestling with how he should introduce Megan to her mother. He had videotapes and photographs, but were he to point to dyed paper or a phosphor screen and tell his daughter, "That's Mommy," might it make her think that all life was artificial? What effect would it have on her development? It was one more question in the life of a man supposed to find answers. The single fatherhood enforced on him by fate had made him all the more devoted as a father, and this on top of a professional career in which he'd worked no less than 6 kidnappings all the way to conclusion. 6'4", 200 wiry pounds, he had sacrificed his Zapata mustache to the requirements of headquarters division. But tough guy among tough guys, his attention to his daughter would have made his colleagues chuckle. Her hair was blondish and long, and each morning he brushed it to silky smoothness after dressing her in colorful toddler clothes and helping her with her tiny sneaks. For Megan, Daddy was a great big protective bear who towered into the blue sky and snatched her off the ground like a rocket so that she could wrap her arms around his neck.
"Oof," Daddy said, "you hugged too hard."
"Did I hurt?" Megan asked in mock alarm.
It was part of the morning routine. A smile. "No, not this time." With that, he walked out of the house and opened the door to his muddy pickup, carefully strapped her into her car seat, and set her lunchbox and blankie between them. It was 6:30, and they were on their way to a new daycare center. O'Day could not start his truck without looking down at Megan, the image of her mother, a daily realization that always made him bite his lip and close his eyes and shake his head, wondering again why the 737 had rolled and plunged straight into the ground with his wife of 16 months in seat 18F. The new daycare center was more convenient to his route to work, and the people next door loved it for their twin boys. He turned left onto Ritchie Highway and found the place right across from a 7-Eleven
where he could get a pint of coffee for the commute in on U.S. 50. Giant Steps. Nice name. Hell of a way to make a living, Pat thought, parking his truck. Marlene Daggett was always there at 6, tending to the children of the bureaucrats who trekked to D.C. every morning. She even came out to meet them for the first arrival.
"Mr. O'Day, and this is Megan," the teacher announced with stunning enthusiasm for so early an hour.
Megan had her doubts and looked up at her daddy. She turned back in surprise to see something special.
"Her name is Megan, too. She's your bear, and she's been waiting all day for you."
"Oh." The little girl seized the brown-furred creature and hugged it, name tag and all.
"Hello."
Mrs. Daggett looked up in a way that told the FBI agent. It works every time.
"You have your blankie?"
"Right here, ma'am," O'Day told her, also handing over the forms he'd completed the night before. Megan had no medical problems, no allergies to medicine, milk, or food. Yes, in case of a real emergency, you can take her to the local hospital. And the inspector's work and pager numbers, and his parents' number, and the number of Deborah's parents, who were damned good grandparents. Giant Steps was well organized. O'Day didn't know how well organized, only because there was something Mrs. Daggett wasn't supposed to talk casually about. His identity was being checked out by the Secret Service.
"Well, Miss Megan, I think it's time for us to play and make some new friends." She looked up. "We'll take good care of her."
O'Day got back into his truck with the usual minor pain that attended leaving his daughter behind. Anywhere, no matter the time or place, and jumped across the street to the 7-Eleven for his commute coffee. He had a conference scheduled at 9 o'clock to go over further developments on the crash investigation. They were down to T-crossing and I-dotting now, followed by a day of administrative garbage, which would at least not prevent him from picking his little girl up on time. 40 minutes later, he pulled into FBI headquarters at 10th and Pennsylvania. His post as roving inspector gave him a reserved parking place. From there he walked this morning to the indoor pistol range. An expert marksman since Boy Scouts, Pat O'Day had also been a principal firearms instructor at several FBI field offices, which meant that he'd been selected by the SAC to supervise weapons training for the other agents, always an important part of a cop's life, even though few ever fired their sidearms in anger. The range was rarely busy this time of day. He got in at 7:25. And the inspector selected 2 boxes of Federal 10mm hollow points for his big stainless Smith & Wesson 1076 automatic, along with a couple of standard Q targets and a set of ear protectors. The target was a simple white cardboard panel with an outline of the vital parts of a human body. The shape resolved itself into the rough size and configuration of a farmer's steel milk can, with the letter Q in the center, about where the heart would be. He attached the target to the spring clip on the traveler, set the distance for 30 feet, and hit the travel switch. As it moved downrange, he let his thoughts idle, contemplating the sports page and the new Orioles lineup in spring training camp. The range hardware was programmable. On arriving at its destination, the target turned sideways and became nearly invisible. Without looking, O'Day dialed the timer to a random setting and continued to look downrange, his hands at his side. Now his thinking changed. There was a bad guy there, a serious bad guy. Convicted felon, now cornered. A bad guy who had told informants that he'd never go back inside, never be taken alive. In his long career, Inspector O'Day had heard that one many times. And whenever possible, he'd given the subject the opportunity to keep his word. But they all folded, dropped their gun, wet their pants, or even broke down into tears when confronted by real danger, instead of the kind more easily considered over beers or a joint. But not this time. This bad guy was serious. He had a hostage. A child, perhaps. Maybe even his own little Megan. The thought made his eyes narrow. A gun to her head. In the movies, the bad guy would tell you to drop your weapon. But if you did that, all you were guaranteed was a dead cop and a dead hostage. And so you talked to your bad guy. You made yourself sound calm and reasonable and conciliatory, and you waited for him to relax just a little, just enough to move the gun away from the hostage's head. It might take hours, but sooner or later... The timer clicked, and the target card turned to face the agent. O'Day's right hand moved in a blur, snatching the pistol from its holster. Simultaneously, his right foot moved backward, his body pivoted and crouched slightly, and the left hand joined the right on the rubber grips when the gun was halfway up. His eyes acquired the gun sights at the bottom of his peripheral vision, and the moment they were aligned with the head of the cue target, his finger depressed the trigger twice, firing so fast that both ejected cartridge cases were in the air at the same time. It was called a double tap, and O'Day had practiced it for so many years that the sounds almost blended in the air. And the two-shot echo was just returning from the steel backstop when the empty cases pinged off the concrete floor. But by then there were two holes in the head of the target, less than an inch apart, between and just above where the eyes would be. The target flipped side-on less than a second after it had turned, rather nicely simulating the fall of the subject to the ground. Yes.
I think you got him there, Tex.
O'Day turned, startled from his fantasy by a familiar voice.
Morning, Director. Hey, Pat.
Murray yawned, a set of ear protectors dangling in his left hand.
You're pretty fast. Hostage scenario? I try to train for the worst possible situation. Your little girl, Murray nodded.
They all did that, because the hostage had to be important enough in your mind.
Well, you got him. Show me again, the director ordered.
He wanted to watch O'Day's technique. There was always something to learn. After the second iteration, there was one ragged hole in the target's notional forehead. It was actually rather intimidating for Murray, though he considered himself an expert marksman.
I need to practice more.
O'Day relaxed his routine now. If you could do it with your first shot of the day, and he'd done it with all four, you still had it figured out. 2 minutes and 20 shots later, the target's head was an annulus. Murray, in the next lane, was busy in the standard Jeff Cooper technique, two rapid shots into the chest, followed by a slower aimed round into the head. When both were satisfied that their targets were dead, it was time to contemplate the day.
Anything new? The director asked.
No, sir. More follow-up interviews on the JAL case are coming in, but nothing startling.
What about Keelty?
O'Day shrugged. He was not allowed to interfere with the OPR investigation, but he did get daily summaries. A case of this magnitude had to be reported to somebody, and though supervision of the case was entirely under the purview of OPR, the information developed also went to the director's office, filtered through his lead roving inspector.
Dan, enough people went in and out of Secretary Hansen's office that anybody could have walked off with the letter, assuming there was one, which our people think there probably was. At least Hansen talked to enough people about it, or so those people tell us.
I think that one will just blow over, Murray observed.
Good morning, Mr. President.
Another day in the routine. The kids were off. Kathy was off. Ryan emerged from his quarters, suited and tied. His jacket was buttoned, which was unusual for him, or had been until moving in here, and his shoes shined by one of the valet staff. Except that Jack still couldn't think of this place as a home. More like a hotel, or the VIP quarters he'd had while traveling on agency business, albeit far more ornate and with much better service.
"You're Raymond?" the president asked.
"Yes, sir," Special Agent Arif Raymond replied.
He was 6 feet and solidly built, more a weightlifter than a runner, Jack thought, though that might come from the body armor that many of the detail members wore. Ryan judged his age at middle 30s. Good-looking in a Mediterranean sort of way, with a shy smile and eyes as blue as surgeons,
"Swordsman is moving," he said into his microphone, to the office.
"Raymond, where's that from?" Jack asked, on the way to the elevator.
"Mother Lebanese, father Iranian. Came over in 79 when the Shah had his problems. Dad was close to the regime."
"So what do you think of the Iraq situation?" the president asked.
"Sir, I hardly even speak the language anymore."
The agent smiled.
"Now, if you want to ask me about who's looking good in the NCAA finals, I'm your man."
"Kentucky," Ryan said decisively.
The White House elevator was old, pre-Art Deco in the interior finishings, with worn black buttons, which the president wasn't allowed to push. Raymond did that for him.
"Oregon's going all the way."
"I'm never wrong, sir. Ask the guys. I won the last three pools. Nobody'll bet against me anymore. The finals will be Oregon and Duke, my school, and Oregon will win by 6 or 8.
"Well, maybe less if Maceo Rawlings has a good night," Raymond added.
"What did you study at Duke?"
"Pre-law, but I decided I didn't want to be a lawyer. Actually, I decided that criminals shouldn't have any rights, and so I figured I'd rather be a cop and I joined the service."
"Married?"
Ryan wanted to know the people around him. At one level, it was mere good manners. At another, these people were sworn to defend his life, and he couldn't treat them like employees.
"Never found the right girl, at least not yet."
"Muslim?"
"My parents were, but after I saw all the trouble religion caused them, well..." He grinned. "If you ask around, they'll tell you my religion is ACC basketball. I never miss a Duke game on the TV. Damn shame Oregon's so tough this year. But that's one thing you can't change."
The president chuckled at the truth of that statement.
"Arif, you said your first name?"
"Actually, they call me Jeff.
Easier to pronounce," Raymond explained as the door opened.
The agent positioned himself in the center of the doors, blocking a direct line of sight to POTUS. A member of the uniform division was standing there, along with two more of the detail, all of them known by sight to Raymond. With a nod, he walked out, with Ryan in tow, and the group turned west, past the side corridor that led to the bowling alley and the carpenter shops.
"Okay, Jeff, an easy day planned," Ryan told him unnecessarily. "The Secret Service knew his daily schedule before he did."
"Easy for us, maybe."
They were waiting for him in the Oval Office. The Foleys, Bert Vasco, Scott Adler, and one other person stood when the president walked in. They'd already been scanned for weapons and nuclear material.
"Ben," Jack said.
He paused to set his early morning papers on the desk and joined his guests.
"Mr. President," Dr. Ben Goodley replied with a smile.
"Ben's prepared the morning brief," Ed Foley explained. Since not all of the morning visitors were part of the inner circle, Raymond would stay in the room, lest somebody leap across the coffee table and try to strangle the president. A person didn't need a firearm to be lethal. A few weeks of study and practice could turn any reasonably fit person into enough of a martial arts expert to kill an unwary victim. For that reason, members of the detail carried not only pistols, but also apps, police batons made of telescoping steel segments. Raymond watched as this Goodley, a carded national intelligence officer, handed out the briefing sheets. Like many members of the Secret Service, he got to hear nearly everything. The eyes-only president sticker on a particularly sensitive folder didn't really mean that. There was almost always someone else in the room, and while the detail members professed even among themselves not to pay any attention to such things, what that really meant was that they didn't discuss them very much. Not hearing and not remembering were something else. Cops were not trained or paid to forget things, much less to ignore them. In that sense, Raymond thought he was the perfect spy. Trained by the United States of America to be a law enforcement officer, he had performed brilliantly in the field, mainly in counterfeiting cases. He was a proficient marksman and a very organized thinker, a trait revealed all the way back in his schooling. He'd graduated from Duke summa cum laude, with nothing less than an A grade on his transcript, plus he'd been a varsity wrestler. It was useful for an investigator to have a good memory, and he did. Photographic, in fact.
a talent which had attracted the detail leadership to him early on, because the agents protecting the president needed to be able to recognize a particular face instantly from the scores of photographs which they carried when the boss was out pressing flesh. During the Fowler administration, as a junior agent gazetted to the detail from the St. Louis field office to cover a fundraising dinner, he'd ID'd and detained a suspected presidential stalker who'd turned out to have a .22 automatic in his pocket. Raymond had pulled the man from the crowd so quietly and skillfully that the subject's processing into the Missouri State Mental Health System had never made the papers, which was just what they tried to achieve. The young agent had detail written all over him. The then-director of the United States Secret Service had decided on reviewing the case, and so Raymond had been transferred over soon after Roger Durling's ascent to the presidency. As a junior member of the detail, he'd stood boring hours on post, run alongside the presidential limousine, and gradually worked his way up rather rapidly for a young man. He'd worked the punishing hours without complaints, only commenting from time to time that, as an immigrant, he knew how important America was. And as his distant ancestors might have served Darius the Great as one of the immortals, so he relished doing the same for his new country. It was so easy, really, much easier than the task his brother, ethnic, not biological, had performed in Baghdad a short time earlier. Americans, whatever they might say to pollsters, truly loved immigrants in their large and foolish hearts. They knew much, and they were always learning. But one thing they had yet to learn was that you could never look into another human heart. "No assets we can use on the ground," Mary Pat was saying. "Good intercepts, though," Goodley went on. "The NSA is really coming through for us. The whole Ba'at leadership is in the jug, and I don't think they're going to be coming out, at least not standing up." "So Iraq is fully decapitated?" "A military ruling council, colonels and junior generals. Afternoon TV showed them with an Iranian mullah. No accident," Bert Vasco said positively. "The least that comes out of this is a rapprochement with Iran. At most, the two countries merge. We'll know that in a couple of days, 2 weeks at the outside." "The Saudis?" Ryan asked. "They're having kittens, Jack," Ed Foley replied at once. "I talked with Prince Ali less than an hour ago. They cobbled together an aid package that would just about have paid off our national debt in an effort to buy the new Iraqi regime. Did it overnight. Biggest goddamn letter of credit ever drafted. But nobody's answering the phone. That has 'em shook in Riyadh. Iraq's always been willing to talk business. Not now." And that would be what frightened all the states on the Arabian Peninsula, Ryan knew. It wasn't well appreciated in the West that the Arabs were businessmen. Not ideologues, not fanatics, not lunatics, but businessmen. Theirs was a maritime trading culture that predated Islam, a fact remembered in America only in remakes of Sinbad the Sailor movies. In that sense, they were very like Americans, despite the difference in language, clothing, and religion. And, just like Americans, they had trouble understanding people who were not willing to do business, to reach an accommodation, to make some sort of exchange. Iran was such a country, changed from the previous state of affairs under the Shah by the Ayatollah Khomeini into a theocracy. "They're not like us," was the universal point of concern for any culture. "They're not like us any more" would be a very frightening development for Gulf states who'd always known that, despite political differences, there had always been an avenue of commonality and communication. "Tehran?" Jack asked next. Ben Goodley took the question unto himself. Official news broadcasts welcome the development, the routine offers of peace and renewed friendship, but nothing beyond that at this point, Goodley said. Officially, that is. Unofficially, we're getting all sorts of intercept traffic. People in Baghdad are asking for instructions, and people in Tehran are giving them. For the moment, they're saying to let the situation develop apace. The revolutionary courts come next. We're seeing a lot of Islamic clergy on TV preaching love and freedom and all that nice stuff. When the trials start and people start backing into walls to pose for rifle fire, then there's going to be a total vacuum.
Then Iran takes over, probably, or maybe runs Iraq like a puppet on a string, Vasco said, flipping through the latest set of intercepts. Goodley may be right. I'm reading the SIGINT stuff for the first time.
Excuse me, Mr. President, but I've been concentrating on the political side. This stuff is more revealing than I expected it to be.
You're saying it means more than I think it does? The NIO asked.
Vasco nodded without looking up.
I think it might. This is not good, the desk officer opined darkly.
Later today, the Saudis are going to ask us to hold their hand, Secretary Adler pointed out. What do I tell them?
Ryan's reply was so automatic that it startled him.
Our commitment to the kingdom is unchanged. If they need us, we're there, now and forever.
And with two sentences, Jack thought a second later, he had committed the full power and credibility of the United States of America to a non-democratic country 7,000 miles away. Fortunately, Adler made it easier for him.
I fully agree, Mr. President. We can't do anything else.
Everyone else nodded agreement, even Ben Goodley.
We can do that quietly. Prince Ali understands, and he can make the king understand that we're not kidding.
Next stop, Ed Foley said. We have to brief Tony Brentano in. He's pretty good, by the way. Knows how to listen, the DCI designate informed the president. You plan to do a cabinet meeting about this?
Ryan shook his head.
No, I think we should play this one cool. America is observing regional developments with interest, but there's nothing for us to get excited about. Scott, you handle the press briefing through your people.
Right, Sextate replied.
Ben, what do they have you doing at Langley now?
Mr. President, they went and made me a senior watch officer for the operations center.
Good briefing, Ryan told the younger man, then turned to the DCI.
Ed, he works for me now. I need an NIO who speaks my language.
Gee, do I at least get a decent relief pitcher back? Foley replied with a laugh.
This kid's a good prospect, and I expect to be in the pennant race this fall.
Nice try, Ed.
Ben, your hours just got worse. For now you can have my old office around the corner. The food's a lot better here, the president promised.
Throughout it all, Arif Raymond stood still, leaning against the white-painted walls while his eyes flickered automatically from one visitor to another. He was trained not to trust anyone, with the possible exceptions of the president's wife and kids. No one else. Of course, they all trusted him, including the ones who had trained him not to trust anyone, because everybody had to trust somebody.
It was just a matter of timing, really. And one of the things his American education and professional training had conferred upon him was the patience to wait for the chance to make the proper move. But other events on the other side of the globe were bringing that moment closer. Behind expressionless eyes, Raymond thought that maybe he needed guidance. His mission was no longer the random event he'd promised to fulfill 20 years earlier. That he could do almost any time. But he was here now, and while anyone could kill, and while a dedicated person could kill almost anyone, only a truly skilled assassin could kill the proper person at the proper moment in pursuit of a larger goal. So deliciously ironic, he thought, that while his mission came from God, every factor in its accomplishment had come directly from the great Satan himself, embodied in the life of one man who could best serve Allah by departing this life at just the proper moment. Picking the moment would be the hard part, and so after 20 years Raymond decided that he might just have to break cover after all. There was danger in that, but he judged a slight one.
"Your objective is a bold one," Bedrine said calmly.
Inwardly he was anything but calm. It was breathtaking.
"The meek do not inherit the earth," Dariai replied,
having for the first time explained his mission in life to someone outside his own inner circle of clerics. It was a struggle for both of them to act like gamblers around a poker table, while they discussed a plan that would change the shape of the world. For Dariai it was a concept toward which he'd labored and thought and planned for more than a generation.
the culmination of everything he'd ever done in life, the fulfillment of a dream, and such a goal as to put his name aside that of the Prophet himself, if he achieved it. The unification of Islam. That was how he typically expressed it in his inner circle. Badrine merely saw the power. The creation of a new superstate centered on the Persian Gulf, a state with immense economic power, a huge population, self-sustaining in every detail, and able to expand across Asia and Africa, perhaps fulfilling the wishes of the Prophet Muhammad, though he didn't pretend to know what the founder of his religion would or would not have wished. He left that to men like Daryai. For Badrine, the game was simply power, and religion or ideology merely defined the team identities. His team was this one because of where he'd been born, and because he'd once looked closely at Marxism and decided it was insufficient to the task.
"It is possible," Badrine said after a few more seconds of contemplation. "The historical moment is unique. The great Satan..." He didn't really like to fall into ideological cant in discussions of statecraft, but sometimes there was no avoiding it. "Is weak. The lesser Satan is destroyed, with its Islamic republics ready to fall into our laps. They need an identity, and what better identity could there be than the Holy Faith?" "And that was entirely true," Badrine agreed with a silent nod. "The collapse of the Soviet Union and its replacement with the so-called Confederation of Independent States had merely generated a vacuum not yet filled. The southern tier of republics were still economically tied to Moscow, rather like a series of carts hitched to a dying horse. They'd always been rebellious, unsettled many nations whose religion had set them apart from the atheist empire, and now they were all struggling to establish their own economic identity so that they could once and for all separate themselves from the center of a dead country to which they'd never truly belonged. But they couldn't sustain themselves economically, not in the modern age. They all needed another patron, another guide into the new century. That new leadership had to mean money, and lots of it, plus the unifying banner of religion and culture long denied them by Marxism-Leninism. In return, the republics would provide land and people, and resources.
"The obstacle is America, but you do not need me to tell you that," Badrine observed unnecessarily.
"And America is too large and powerful to destroy."
"I've met this Ryan.
But first you tell me what you think of him."
"He's no fool, and no coward," Badrine said judiciously.
"He has shown physical bravery, and he is well-versed in intelligence operations. He is well-educated. The Saudis trust him, as do the Israelis." Those two countries mattered at this moment. So did a third. "The Russians know and respect him."
"What else?"
"Do not underestimate him. Do not underestimate America. We have both seen what happens to those who do," Badrine said.
"But America's current state?"
"What I have seen tells me that President Ryan is working hard to reconstitute the government of his country. It is a huge task. But America is a fundamentally stable country."
"What about the problem in the succession?"
"This I do not understand," Badrine admitted. "I haven't seen enough news reports to understand the issues."
"I have met Ryan," Daryai said, finally revealing his own thoughts.
"He is an assistant, nothing more. He appears strong, but is not. Were he a man of strength, he would deal with this Kielty directly. The man commits treason, does he not? But this is not important. Ryan is one man. America is one country. Both can be attacked at the same time from more than one direction." "Lion and hyenas," Badrine noted, then explained himself. Daryai was so pleased with the idea that he didn't object to his own place in the metaphor.
"Not one great attack, but many small ones?" the cleric asked.
It has worked before.
And what of many large ones?
Against America and against Ryan.
For that matter, what if Ryan were to fall? What would happen then, my young friend?
Within their system of government, chaos would result.
But I would counsel caution. I would also recommend allies. The more hyenas and the more directions, the better to harry the lion.
As for attacking Ryan personally, Badrain went on, wondering why his host had said that, and wondering if it was an error.
The President of the United States is a difficult target, well protected and well informed.
"So I am told," Daryai replied, behind dark eyes devoid of expression.
"What other countries would you recommend as our allies?"
"Have you paid close attention to the conflict between Japan and America?" Badrain asked. "Did you ever wonder why some large dogs did not bark at all?"
"It was a funny thing about large dogs. They were always hungry. More than once now, however, Daryai had talked about Ryan and his protection. One dog was the hungriest of all. It would make for an interesting pack."
"Maybe it just malfunctioned."
The Gulfstream representatives were sitting in a room with Swiss civil aviation officials, along with the chief of flight operations of the corporation which owned the jets. His written records showed that the aircraft had been properly maintained by a local firm. All parts had come from the approved suppliers. The Swiss corporation, which did the maintenance, had 10 years of accident-free history behind it, regulated in turn by the same government agency which oversaw the investigation.
"It wouldn't be the first time," the Gulfstream rep agreed.
The flight data recorder was a robust piece of hardware. But they didn't always survive crashes, because every crash was different. A careful search by USS Radford had failed to turn up the locator pings. Absent that, the bottom was too deep for an undirected search, and then there was the issue of the Libyans, who didn't want ships poking around their waters. Had the missing aircraft been an airliner, the issue might have been pushed. But a business jet with a crew of 2 and 3 reported passengers, one of them with a deadly plague, wasn't important enough.
"Without the data, there isn't much to be said. Engine failure was reported, and that could mean bad fuel, bad maintenance."
"Please," the maintenance contractor objected.
"I'm speaking theoretically," Gulfstream pointed out. "Or even pilot error of some sort or other. Without hard data, our hands are pretty well tied."
"The pilot had 4,000 hours in type. The co-pilot had over 2,000, the owner's representative said for the fifth time this afternoon.
They were all thinking the same thing. The aircraft manufacturer had a superb safety record to defend. There were relatively few airliner manufacturers for the big carriers to choose from. And as important as safety was for them, it was even more so for the builders of business jets, for whom competition was stiffer. The buyers of such corporate toys had long memories, and without hard information to hang their hats on about the few crashes which took place, all they remembered was a missing aircraft with missing passengers.
The maintenance contractor had no wish to be firmly associated with a fatal accident either. Switzerland had a lot of airfields and a lot of business aircraft. A bad maintainer could lose business as well, not to mention the trouble from the Swiss government for violating its stringent civil aviation rules. The corporate owner had the least to lose in terms of reputation, but amour propre would not allow him to assume responsibility without real cause. And there was no real cause for any of them to take the blame, not without the flight data recorder. The men looked at one another around the table, thinking the same thought. Good people did make mistakes, but rarely did they wish to admit them, and never when they didn't have to. The government representative had gone over the written records and been satisfied that the paperwork was all correct. Beyond that, there was nothing any of them could do except talk to the engine manufacturer and try to get a sample of the fuel.
The former was easy. The latter was not. In the end, they'd know little more than they knew now. Gulfstream might lose a plane or two in sales. The maintenance contractor would undergo increased government scrutiny. The corporation would have to buy a new jet. To show loyalty, it would be another G-class business jet, and with the same maintenance contractor. That would please everybody, even the Swiss government. Being a roving inspector paid more than being a street agent, and it was more fun than sitting behind a desk all the time. But Pat O'Day still chafed at spending most of his day reading over written reports generated by agents or their secretaries. More junior people cross-checked the data for inconsistencies, though he did the same, keeping careful penciled notes on his own yellow pad, which his secretary would collate for his summary reports to Director Murray. Real agents, O'Day believed implicitly, didn't type. Well, that's what his instructors at Quantico would have said, probably. He finished his meetings early down at Buzzard's Point and decided that his office in the Hoover Building didn't need him. The investigation was indeed at the point of diminishing returns. The new information was all interviews, every single one of which confirmed information already developed and already verified by voluminous cross-referenced documents.
"I've always hated this part," ADIC Tony Caruso said. It was the point when the United States attorney had everything he needed to get a conviction, but, being a lawyer, never had enough. As though the best way to convict a hood were to bore the jury to death.
"Not even a sniff of contrary data. This one's in the bag, Tony." The two men had long been friends. "Time for me to get something new and exciting."
"Lucky you. How's Megan?"
"New daycare center started today. Giant steps on Ritchie Highway."
"Same one," Caruso observed.
"Yeah, I guess it would be."
"Huh?"
"The Ryan kids."
"Oh, you weren't here back then when those ULA bastards hit it."
"She didn't."
"The owner of the place didn't say anything about."
"Well, I guess she wouldn't, would she?"
"Our brethren are a little tight-assed about that. I imagine the service gave her a long brief on what she can and cannot say."
"Probably an agent or two helping with the finger painting."
O'Day thought for a second. There was a new clerk at the 7-Eleven across the street. He'd remembered thinking, when he'd gotten his coffee, that the guy was a little too clean-cut for that early in the morning. Tomorrow he'd eyeball the guy for a weapon, as the clerk had surely done with him already. And out of professional courtesy, he'd show his ID, along with a wink and a nod.
"Kinda overqualified," Caruso agreed. "But what the hell, can't hurt to know there's coverage where your kid is."
"You bet, Tony." O'Day stood. "Anyway, I think I'll go and pick her up."
"Headquarters puke. 8-hour day," the assistant director in charge of the Washington field office grumped.
"You're the one who wanted to be a big shot, Don Antonio."
It was always liberating to leave work. The air smelled fresher on the way out than on the way in. He walked out to his truck, noting that it hadn't been touched or stolen. There was an advantage to dirt and mud. He shed his suit jacket, O'Day rarely bothered with an overcoat, and slipped into his 10-year-old leather one, a Navy-type flight jacket worn just enough to be comfortable. The tie was disposed of next. 10 minutes later he was outbound on Route 50 toward Annapolis, just ahead of the bow wave of government commuters, and listening to Country and Western on the radio. Traffic was especially favorable today, and just before the hourly news he pulled into the Giant Steps parking lot, this time looking for official cars. The Secret Service was fairly clever about that. Like the Bureau, its automobiles were randomly tagged, and they'd even learned not to go with the obvious cheap body, neutral paint motif that fingered so many unmarked cop cars. He spotted two even so, and confirmed his suspicions by parking next to one and looking down inside to see the radio. That done, he wondered about his own disguise and decided to see how good they were, then realized that if they were halfway competent,
They'd already checked out his ID through the documents he'd handed over to Mrs. Daggett that very morning. Or, more likely, even before. There was a considerable professional rivalry between the FBI and the USSS. In fact, the former had been started with a handful of Secret Service agents. But the FBI had also grown much larger, and along the way accumulated far more corporate experience in criminal investigation. Which was not to say the service wasn't damned good, though, as Tony Caruso had truthfully observed, very tight-assed. Well, they were probably the world's foremost babysitters. He walked across the parking lot with his jacket zipped up, and spotted a big guy just inside the door. Would he stay covert? O'Day walked right past him, just another father in to pick up his munchkin. Inside, it was just a matter of checking out the clothes and the earpieces. Yep, two female agents wearing long smocks, and under them would be Zigzauer 9mm automatics. "Daddy!" Megan hooted, leaping to her feet. Next to her was another child of similar age and looks. The inspector headed over, bending down to look at the day's crayoning. "Excuse me." And he felt light hand pressure through the jacket on his service automatic. "You know who I am," he said without turning. "Oh, I do now." And then O'Day recognized the voice. He turned to see Andrea Price. "Demoted?" He stood to look her in the face. The two female agents, mingled with the kids, were also watching him closely, alerted by the bulge under the leather jacket. Not bad, O'Day thought. They'd had to look closely. The bulk of the leather was good concealment. Both had their gun hands off whatever educational task they'd been performing, and the looks in their eyes would appear casual only to the unschooled. "Sweep. Checking out arrangements for all the kids," she explained. "This is Katie," Megan said, introducing her new friend. "And that's my daddy." "Well, hello, Katie." He bent down again to shake her hand, then stood again. "Is she?" "Sandbox, first toddler of the United States," Price confirmed. "And one across the street?" "Business first." "Two. Relays." "She looks like her mom," Pat said of Katie Ryan. And, just to be polite, he pulled out his official ID and tossed it to the nearest female agent, Marcella Hilton. "You want to be a little careful testing us, okay?" Price asked. "Your man at the door knew who I was coming in. He looks like he's been around the block." "Don Russell, and he has, but..." "But ain't no such thing as too careful," Inspector O'Day agreed. "Yeah, okay, I admit it. I wanted to see how careful you were. Hey, my little girl's here, too. I guess this place is a target now." "Damn," he didn't say aloud. "So, do we pass?" "One across the street, three I can see here. I bet you have three more camped out within 100 yards. Want me to look for the Suburban and the long guns?" "Look hard, we've got them well concealed." She didn't mention the one in the building he hadn't spotted. "I bet you do, Agent Price," O'Day agreed, catching the clue and looking around some more. There were two disguised TV cameras that must have gone in recently. That also explained the faint smell of paint, which in turn explained the lack of little handprints on the walls. The building was probably wired like a pinball machine. "I must admit, you guys are pretty smooth." "Good," he concluded. "Anything new on the crash?" Pat shook his head. "Not really. We went over some additional interviews at WFO today. The only inconsistencies are too minor to count for much of anything. The Mounties are doing a hell of a job for us, by the way. So are the Japs. I think they've talked to everybody from Sato's kindergarten teacher on up. They even turned two stewardesses he was playing with on the side. This one's in the bag, Price." "Andrea," she replied. "Pat." And they both smiled. "What do you carry?" "Smith 1076. Better than that 9mm mouse gun you guys pack." This was delivered with a somewhat superior attitude. O'Day believed in making big holes, to date only in targets, but in people if necessary. The Secret Service had its own weapons policy, and in that area he was sure the Bureau had better ideas. She didn't bite.
"Do us a favor. Next time you come in, show your ID to the agent out front. Might not always be the same one."
She didn't even ask him to leave it in his truck. Damn, there was professional courtesy.
"So, how's he doing?"
"Swordsman?"
"Dan, Director Murray, thinks the world of him. They go back a ways. So do Dan and I."
"Tough job, but you know, Murray's right. I've met worse men. He's smarter than he lets on, too.
The times I've been around him, he listens well.
Better than that, he asks questions."
They both turned when a kid yelled, swept the room at the same time and in the same way, then turned back to the two little girls, who were sharing crayons for their respective works of art.
"Yours and ours seem to get along."
"Ours," Pat thought. That said it all. The big old bruiser at the door, Russell, she'd said. He'd be the chief of the sub-detail, and sure as hell that was one experienced agent. They'd have selected younger ones, both women, for inside work, the better to blend in. They'd be good, but not as good as he was. Ours was the key word, though. Like lions around their cubs, or just one cub in this case. O'Day wondered how he'd handle this job. It would be boring just standing post like that, but you couldn't allow yourself to get bored. That would be a fight. He'd done his share of discreet surveillance assignments, quite a feat for one of his size, but this would be far worse. Even so, a cop's eye saw the difference between them and the other preschool teachers in the room.
"Andrea, looks to me like your people know their job. Why so many?"
"I know we have this one overmanned." Price tilted her head. "We're still figuring this one out. Hey, we took a big hit on the hill, you know. Ain't gonna be any more, not on my watch. Not while I run the detail. And if the press makes noise about it, fuck 'em."
She even talked like a real cop.
"Ma'am, that's just fine with me.
Well, with your permission, I have to go home and make cheese and macaronis."
He looked down. Megan was about finished with her masterpiece. The two little girls were difficult to tell apart, at least for the casual observer. That was distantly worrisome, but that was also the reason the service was here.
"Where do you practice?"
He didn't have to say, "Practice what?"
"There's a range in the old post office building, convenient to the White House. Every week," she told him. "There's not an agent here who's short of expert, and I'll put Don up against anybody in the world."
"Really?"
O'Day's eyes sparkled.
"One day we'll have to see."
"Your place or mine?" Price asked, with a twinkle of her own.
"Mr. President, Mr. Golovko on three." That was the direct line. Sergei Nikolaevich was showing off again. Jack pushed the button.
"Yes, Sergei."
"Iran."
"I know," the president said.
"How much?" the Russian asked. "His bag's already packed to go home."
"We'll know in 10 days or so for sure."
"Agreed.
I offer cooperation."
This was getting to be habit-forming, Jack thought, but it was always something to think over first.
"I will discuss that with Ed Foley. When will you be back home?"
"Tomorrow."
"Call me then."
Amazing that he could speak so efficiently with a former enemy. He'd have to get Congress trained that way, the president thought with a smile. Ryan stood from his desk and headed into the secretary's room.
"How about some munchies before my next appointment?"
"Hello, Mr. President," Price said. "Have a minute?"
Ryan waved her in while his number two secretary called the mess.
"Yes?"
"Just wanted to tell you, I looked over the security arrangements for your children. It's pretty tight."
If this was supposed to please POTUS, he didn't show it, Andrea thought. But that was understandable. "Hey, we have enough bodyguards on your children." What a world it was. 2 minutes later, she was talking with Raymond, who was ready to head off duty, having arrived in the White House at 5 a.m. There was, as usual, nothing to report.